On this episode of This Week in Space, we're talking UFOs, UAPs, and tinfoil hats with Leonard David, space journalist. Stay with us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 66, recorded on June 16th, 2023. Look to the skies for a warning.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, to the Look to the Skies for a Warning edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. I'm here with the illustrious Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief at space.com. Good day, sir.
Good day, Rod. I got my conspiracy hat on and everything for today, so I'm pretty excited.
You look like a Muppet.
But my solar panels.
You look like a space Muppet. Okay, very good. Today, we have the good fortune to have one of our favorite returning guests, Leonard David, the Big Kahuna of Space Reporting, with us. Hello, Leonard.
Hi, good to be here.
Good to have you. Thanks so much for coming on. Before we begin...
Tarek looks like, a Mickey Mouse solar edition or something.
He looks like a Mickey Mouse after experiencing way too much cosmic radiation.
Oh, no.
Having his genes scrambled. All right, but before we begin, it's that time again, I'm sorry to say, for a new space dad joke from listener Kurt Gugalev. I hope I said that correctly. Hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
How do we know that the metric system is truly universal?
I don't know how.
Because aliens always say, take me to your leader. Oh, I got it today.
As always,
we invite you to join Malik's Marauders and send us your best or worst space joke. And don't forget to do us a solid and make sure to like, subscribe, and all those other great podcast things. Because after all, it's free. We love you and we hope you love us. Now it's time to go to some headlines. First one. From Live Science, what I like to call tentacles on my mind. Take it away, Tarek.
Well, this is an interesting one from our space.com sister publication, Live Science, and it's about NASA's Apollo 11 mission. And basically, when NASA first landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and sent Mike Collins around the moon back in 1969, they thought that, oh my gosh, there's going to be like Mars germs, like Andromeda strain, and they're going to bring space plague back to Earth. So they had this whole quarantine procedure where they came out in like hazmat suits. They got put in this little Astrovan type thing for a while.
Hermetically sealed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a new study that just came out is saying that all of those kind of precautions, it was in the science journal ISIS, maybe weren't as hermetically sealed or as needed as possible. So the study here, it says that their quarantine facility at the in Houston at the Lunar Receiving Lab, while they had like the best intention, that the money and the resources in it were mostly kind of for show, that the quarantine procedure and protocol really wasn't needed. And it was something that did eventually get bore out pretty quickly, after you don't see astronauts today coming back from space in hermetically sealed places. And I doubt we'll see the Artemis astronauts themselves come out. But it is just an interesting kind of glimpse at like the time of the era where we didn't really know what was going to happen. So they just built this multi-million dollar facility to keep their astronauts away from the rest of us. There they are with President Richard Nixon inside their sealed little trailer on the Hornet, actually, that recovered them. So just a really fun one. The study author, Dagmar de Groot, he's a historian at Georgetown University. He wrote that paper and it was a success just because they didn't need it. Right. And it was just a nice little lesson about what you might need to pay for and what you might not need to pay for, when you're going to the moon. I wonder if they'll do this for Mars though, right? Because it's a different place. It's got its own atmosphere. It's got its own ice and water and all that stuff. So I'm curious. Even if it wasn't needed for the moon, if when NASA has their Mars astronauts come back, they'll quarantine them again to make sure that we don't get Mars plague or something like that.
Well, personally, if we come back from Mars with microbes, I'm looking forward to having a tentacle because it would up my rate in my television appearances. I'm sorry, Elena, were you going to say something?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that it's a great paper the guy wrote. And, you know, he brings out a lot of points that you should be worried about with the Mars activity because, you know, it was a public affairs stunt. The whole Apollo quarantine program. And, you know, it was so botched up in a lot of ways. You know, when they open the door on the ocean with the and they throw in the biological suits, I mean, right away, you know, anything in there got out into the atmosphere.
Right.
So it was pretty much a kind of a pathetic way to do it. And if you remember, and I do. They had a guy there when the Apollo astronauts walked out the helicopter. He had a spray can spraying their feet as they walked by. You know, this is all going to make a big difference. So, luckily, or maybe unluckily in some ways, Nixon didn't get anything because of the biofeedback.
Well, we can always hope. So next up from space.com, we have It's Alive, phosphates on Enceladus.
Yeah, well, we don't know if it's alive or not. What we know is that they have detected massive amounts of phosphorus coming out of the icy moon Enceladus. Enceladus. Enceladus is the tastiest of moons with its cheesy center. Yeah. But no, Enceladus, the icy moon of Saturn, has these water geysers, that erupt from these tiger stripe areas on it. And scientists have got, you know, using data from it's gone now, but the Cassini spacecraft, said that they found, massive amounts of phosphorus, which is a key kind of building block for life as we know it. Like we have it. We all need it in our bodies. I think we get it right from bananas. Is that right?
Bananas,
anyway, yeah. So, but it's used, it's used with sugars to form our skeleton, our DNA molecules. It repairs cell membranes, all that stuff. And they have found what seems like, 500 more times a concentration of phosphorus coming out of Enceladus than there is in our entire ocean, which is just teeming with life. And it's a really hearty indicator that like Enceladus and its ocean, under the ground is a ripe place for life to possibly evolve. They didn't find life. They made that real clear. In fact, Frank Postberg, one of the professors that led the research said, and I quote, "We didn't find life or even something that was created by life." So they just found the signs of something that indicates that life could form there. Pretty good. So a pretty good indicator that life could form there. And of course, this is what makes Enceladus and a lot of other icy moons like it in our solar system really tantalizing places to look for possible signs of life. Because everywhere on Earth where there's water, there's some kind of life, even if it's microbial. And they know that it's warm at the bottom of the oceans of Enceladus because it's that heat dynamic is powering these eruptions out of the surface. And then they know that there's a lot of liquid water there, a lot of liquid water, like the whole moon could be covered in it under this icy shell. And so it's just another reason why we need to go there. And then when we get there, be very careful how we treat that place because we don't want to bring any earth microbes, which are the moon ones, to contaminate that place.
And I think it's Enceladus. Is there some reason you're not going with Enceladus? Enceladus. So my hope is when we get there, so when Leonard and I were growing up, a big thing you saw when you read comic books in the back pages and the ads was sea monkeys, which were brine shrimp that you got in a little dried, freeze-dried packet. And then you got this little tiny plastic aquarium with this little goofy amusement park molded in the bottom. And the illustration showed these sea monkeys dressed up to go out in the town of the amusement park with smiling faces, holding the hands of their sea monkey children and all that. And of course, when you got it, you just had, you know, dead brine shrimp floating at the top of it after a couple of days. But I hope that in Enceladus, we'll find that, you know, we really get at least sea monkeys that have personalities and they're kind of like Dr. Seuss, Little Horton, Here's a Who, a monkey's a monkey, no matter how small kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, all these worlds are yours, Rod, except Enceladus. I'll say Enceladus. I like saying Enceladus because then I can say enchiladas, but I'm sure, you know, potato.
Don't forget Europa.
That's right. That's right.
The easy amusement of small minds. All right. So let's take a quick break. I'm sorry. That was nasty. And who spilled their coffee on whose lap this morning, my friend?
I'll get a better setup. So.
Biggest thrill of the day. So let's take a short break for a sponsor and we'll be right back. And we are back for this week in Space, the Tinfoil Hat Edition. For those of you listening to audio, I am wearing a very cleverly crafted hat that will protect me from any emanations from Leonard's mind, which are substantial.
It looks like an upside down Enterprise, like space Starship Enterprise.
Oh, that's true. I thought it kind of looked like Kagamusha out of that old movie. But all right. So we're here to talk about NASA's new report. I'm going to take this thing off because it's driving me crazy. So we've had in the last 20 years a number of, let's just call them UFO reports. We'll use the term UAP, but you know, just between friends here, let's call them UFOs because we all grew up with that. So for years, decades after Project Blue Book in the 1960s, when the Air Force said, ha, swamp gas and weather balloons, nothing to see here about UFOs, there was a long silence from government and certainly from NASA, who generally in practice would try to debunk these things. And there's some famous ones like the weird sounds from Apollo 10, which we think turned out to be radio interference and so forth. And then we started getting this crackling of new stuff coming out of various circles within the military and government in the 2000s and early teens. And so NASA recently, about 9 months ago, commissioned a study for less than $100,000, which I found a little penurious, but that's okay. With a really good panel of people to look at this out in bright sunlight in the open, fully transparent, unclassified data only. And they had their first public meeting this month, I believe, right?
May 31st.
So end of last month. And Leonard is on this stuff like a hawk on a rodent. So I guess first, Leonard, if you could sort of characterize what the study was, because they weren't trying to do another Project Blue Book. My understanding is they're really studying how to better study things. So it's a study of how to study, in effect. Is that right?
Right. I think that's just of what they were doing with the 16 people, and they're great. These are great individuals. Yeah. That whole panel on the 31st gave, you know, almost to the person, gave pretty good, essays, vocal essays on why they were there and why they're interested. So they were handpicked, but they all signed up for it. And I think the one thing that popped up right at the beginning, within 2 minutes, the guy that was running the show said that some of the people on the panel had been, got bad messages from people that they shouldn't be on the panel and they don't deserve to be on there. So they started off pretty rocky within 10 minutes of the whole NASA briefing.
You mean, Leonard, like they're getting criticized as experts for appearing there?
Yeah, they shouldn't be on there. And there was an oceanographer on there and she shouldn't be on there and this and that. It was pretty kind of interesting right at the very beginning of the, before we even got into what they are trying to determine. So it was pretty interesting and it went on for, seemed forever, but it was a good douse of, you know, where we were thinking about UAPs in terms of NASA. And that was one of the things that's interesting, because I think they're trying to make a case that, you know, NASA is this, kind of unique, transparent agency. And they are the crucible of science there. I mean, that's the impression they were trying to give out. I didn't quite get some of the, patting themselves on the back too much, but they're really dedicated to try to get this report done by summertime, end of, in the summer. So we'll see. But they had a lot of good recommendations. And, you know, I thought it was a very telling and needed, you know, assessment by NASA.
Excuse me, Tara, I'm going to jump just one more thing.
Yeah.
Was this criticism coming from primarily the public or from media or other
no,
science organizations?
I think it was from the diehard UFO folks, you know, that, believers. You know, why is NASA even doing this? Because they're already here and, you know, I got to take my kids home at night because the aliens are outside, you know. So, yeah, they got some feedback right away from some strident UFO folks. And so that came out pretty clear right at the beginning.
Hmm. I just wanted to follow up because you mentioned UAPs and we've talked about UAPs before. And, you know, when UFOs were classified as unidentified aerial phenomena back with during the Navy video releases, et cetera, that came out, everyone kind of was like, oh, why do they have to rebrand UFOs now? But they even kind of tweaked it during the development in the time for this report because they want to include other stuff. So now they call it anomalous phenomena instead of aerial, right?
Yeah, because I think it could transmedium. I mean, people have been thinking about UAPs in terms of going underwater and scooting around at high speed. So, you know, it's anomalous. But I think one thing that I'm still worried about the connection between UFO, which has its own folklore, its own mystique, its own aliens, its own thing, and UAP, which may be totally different phenomenon. And so I find the UAP thing a little worrisome to get it ground into their UFOs. Could be a totally different kind of phenomenon that we're thinking about with UAP.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to elaborate a bit on this panel. So it's 16 people led by David Spergel, who's a former Princeton professor and distinguished astrophysicist. But the panel also included journalists, data scientists, and oceanographers, as you pointed out, another astrophysicist, former Homeland Security official, a NASA policy wonk, science journalist. They didn't ask Tarek or myself, sadly. Space legal experts.
No, but it's Nadia Drake. Nadia Drake is on that panel.
Yeah.
Daughter of Frank Drake, you know?
But still.
So.
You know, uspace.com. Who gets more hits on their website per month? Okay,
I think
probably
Nadia Drake.
Science journalist. Planetary scientist. An astronaut, Scott Kelly.
Scott Kelly, yeah.
Former FAA official or two. New space entrepreneurs, which was interesting, and other computer experts and data people. So this was not a casual group of let's scratch our heads and talk about our interest in flying saucers. This was a bunch of science people. And as Leonard alluded to, you know, part of the purpose of this is to bring, not that the government hasn't necessarily, but to bring some really tough scientific rigor to the question and just figure out how to better look at it and use the data they've got. And one of their preliminary findings was, look, of the unexplained stuff we have, the data just isn't good enough to do what we want to do for serious scientific scrutiny. They need more and better data. Now, some people probably look at it and say, oh, gee, you're skating on this one. But, you know, in an era where all of us have high resolution cameras, sound recording devices in our pockets with smartphones, smartphones can also detect magnetic fields and, of course, give very accurate geolocation info. You're kind of hoping for better stuff. And we're still seeing fuzzy, old, grainy images. And I think we'd all like to see not just more, but that definitive, you know, maybe not landing on the White House lawn, but that definitive image that goes, okay, this is definitely not of terrestrial origin. So it's a robust effort. It wasn't something undertaken casually. And Leonard, I wondered if you could, you may have some comments on what I just said, but also I wonder if you could kind of just walk us quickly through the various efforts and reports that have come out over the last 15 or 20 years, because there's been at least four, right?
Yeah, you're right. The Condon report. There's been a bunch of these that have been done, but this was unique. In the last, we've already had two congressional hearings. I think it's two, and that's pretty interesting to see the Congress weigh in on this. Mainly, I mean, NASA's role has been is this phenomenon of concern for air and space, you know, traffic, you know, situational awareness, you know, that kind of thing. But the Pentagon and the military weighing in and these special offices that have been, this is probably for, if you're a believer in all this, this is the best time to try to figure out what people see. Now, the bad news here to me, when I go through Twitter, which I did this morning, you know, it looks like we're under attack now by all these sightings that people see. Now everybody's sensitized to it. And so everybody's reporting everything. And we just had a thing the other day. I watched this video, and you're talking about blurry video. A family in Las Vegas in their backyard saw a fireball go by. Then they connected that to an alien that they thought they saw. And you get all these jerky videos, and you go through these, and if you add them all up, we must be under attack. There's too many things coming in, you know, and too many people with Twitter accounts seeing so many things and posting. And one of the concerns I have is that people are faking this on purpose. Mm. And here you have a very dedicated scientific investigation. And I'm not sure we shouldn't have more psychologists involved in these studies. Yeah. To find out what is it about, and this is perhaps the thing that drives me to be continually interested in it. Why do people want this to be real? What is it? I mean, it may be real. We may have alien contact. We may be in on the off ramp for planetary visitations. But why is it? Now, and we got the James Webb telescope, all these new findings that are coming in about not how alone we are, but how crowded is it out there with exoplanets. So, psychologically, we seem to want to have this, I guess, but I'm also nervous that we're not prepared. That we're not ready to have the definitive proof that we're on the truck lines for alien crashes. I mean, that's the other thing that bothers me. These people are bad drivers. I mean, we have crashed UFOs, and you know, it's hard to imagine interstellar flight. You've gone that far, and you have no brake fluid. You know.
Yeah, oops.
There's something amiss in some of this with crashed UFOs.
Well, and you brought up something interesting about the hoaxers just very quickly. And down on line 60, I've got a video link in the right-hand column there. In that same incident, I think you were talking about in the desert, I believe it was, somebody then posted a video of an alien creature crawling around somebody's garden.
Right.
And the police showed up and said, we can't find anything and all this stuff. I mean, it's convincing looking. It's an infrared. There's this thing kind of crawling around on all fours that definitely looks like an alien. Later it turned out it was a CGI hoax. And in this day of AI and the ability to create all this convincing imagery, you know, if you're doing something of the Pope, you know, dancing the Lobata or something like that, people are going to go, yeah, maybe not. But something like this looks pretty convincing, and it doesn't help the cause at all.
Yeah. Well, the NASA's assessment, at least now we're acting like these are final conclusions. I think the chief of the whole thing was kept saying that preliminarily this is what we're thinking about. So we don't know exactly what NASA is going to come up with at the end of the day, but it was clear the one signal that I got out of that was, yeah, exactly right. Better data, but also citizen science. Can we bring in more public involvement in this? Because I think I think one of the precepts there is maybe learn the scientific process. I mean, what is truth? What is data? What's good data? What's bad data? So I liked that a lot, and that was a good indication that NASA may set up something where public can be actively involved. That'd be terrific.
There was a really interesting point that NASA's Nikki Fox made during this panel that they had, and it was about the nature of the classification. You know, like why this stuff is classified. This video. From the Navy. And, and she said, you know, if a fighter jet took a picture of the Statue of Liberty, then that image is classified, not because it's a picture of the Statue of Liberty and there's an alien on it, but because of the sensors that they use, the camera that they used for it. Mm-hmm. And I bring it up because it was an interesting take on like why stuff is classified and why they can't maybe talk about it, when they see these things. And I'm curious how that, you know, how that relates to the fact that the Pentagon has this all domain anomaly resolution office that has, you know, that was kind of part of this whole thing that came out with the Navy video and whatnot that led to these discussions there.
Yeah, no, that's right. And they did one good analysis of one of those films, those videos, and did a very detailed look at it. And they were able to, push that off the menu, the things that they've got that are unknown. They also showed something they don't quite understand yet. But the rigor involved in analyzing that video was pretty intense. So I do think that it could be a great opportunity for citizen science because, I mean, we go citizen science like amateur astronomer. You know, it's like, I hate that term. You know, there are people with really dedicated equipment and time that spend more time glued to an eyepiece or glued with a camera system, looking at objects. So I think the public can really get involved. Mike Gold is on the panel, a good friend of mine at Redwire, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he kind of brought up the point of establishing a specific office at NASA to really keep this going. Otherwise, the report will have dust on it in a couple of months, and it'll be like a lot of other reports that he's been engaged in over the decades. And so that was interesting, whether or not NASA would set up a special office. And again, the NASA chief, Bill Nelson, is really kind of got this thing going. I mean, it was his kind of belief that there was something to this, and let's let NASA be involved. All good points.
So one of the things that I found particularly heartening was, I think it was the guy who's leading the study, made an example of, you know, he's saying there's a lot of unknowns here, and that essentially, you know, part of NASA's job is to tackle the unknown. I mean, that's from their charter from the very beginning. And he cited the example of how fast radio bursts were initially dismissed as possibly terrestrial events. We've got other examples with microwave bursts that looked like they might be something space turning out to be.
Sprites.
Well, sprites, but microwave bursts, my favorite, because they saw them and said, hey, these occur right around noon. And then they realized it was people on the horizon microwaving their lunches. But FRBs were initially like sprites, dismissed. And then they said, no, these really are cosmic phenomena. And now we see them all over the place. So that's kind of interesting. And yet in kind of conjunctive to this, one of the things I find confusing is, and part of it, I think, is the different nature of the NASA study to what's gone before. But, a couple of years ago, one of the government studies released said, hey, you know, we can't explain most of these findings. And then the most recent one from that AARO office was, no, only 2-5% remain unexplained. So, what's this disparity? Is it what they're looking at and how?
I guess I don't know what you're getting to there, but it seems like, you know, there's something there. I'm convinced that we've got something, And again, I kind of want to separate the UFO from UAP. Mm. UAP may turn out to be something different than a UFOs coming in and all that. But again, the folklore of UFOs has been around so long. And one thing that's happening, when I grew up with the UFO kind of on the television at the time, back in the 50s, 60s, was a cast of characters. We had George Adamski, that I grew up in San Diego, and Adamski was up in Mount Palomar, and he had just got back from Venus, and you know, said it was very hot there. And as a kid, you go, yeah, that makes sense. But there was Truman Burthen. There was a bunch of people that were a part of that whole folklore. And that's what's happening today. We have another cast of characters that are playing a role in helping the public either be more confused or unravel this kind of unexplained phenomenon we have gotten to appreciate over the decades. And that's a good thing, you know, over the decades. I mean, this has been going on quite a while. And I think any journalist would say there's got to be something here. Something's not quite clicking right in my mind about the UFO phenomenon and UAPs. So something's there. And what it is, it's going to be a learning process, and hopefully NASA can help get the public more in tune to the scientific process to try to analyze what's going on. And we may find a whole different kind of phenomenon that we're not aware of. That would be great.
Pretty exciting. Yeah.
Be exciting. Yeah,
finding any answer that could be validated would be great. We're going to be back with a burning question from Tarek, because I can see it on his face. He's got the big windup for the speedball coming right after this message from our sponsors.
I changed my hat, by the way, because man, that silver one is a bit hot. Kind of cooks your brain. You know, I wanted to ask,
that explains a lot, actually.
You know, getting to your point, Leonard, about UAP and that we don't know what they are, and there's going to be an explanation for them sooner rather than later. And then Rod, you know, you mentioned something earlier about, you know, the fact that everyone has a HD camera, you know, in their pocket these days. And I guess the question that, you know, that I wanted to ask is about, you know, if these studies have been going on for decades, Leonard, and clearly there's something that needs to be identified. The fact that everyone has all of these tools now, it seems like it's a matter of time before something comes out to explain it. And that if this, you know, if a lot of these were, you know, secret tests, stealth aircraft projects or whatnot, that you know, governments or militaries just can't keep that secret as much, because there's so much more personal surveillance that everyone is doing on their own.
Right. I think that is another layer of this thing that, you know, what is classified? I've written quite a number of stories for space.com on identified flying objects. I mean, you know, it turns out a lot of the, you know, back in the U-2 days, SR-71, the Blackbirds, you know, and they got declassified in the 60s. So you can try to imagine what is being tested now. And then you toss in drones of all make and sizes and configurations that people, yeah, if you saw one of those, you'd think it was a UFO. So that's another layer of this. And to their credit, several groups like MUFON and some other groups have tried to put out little catalogs of what you might mistakenly think is a flying unidentified flying object from alien places. And, you know, it can be clouds, it could be all kinds of things. But again, I think this is a learning experience that we're all going through, and how we're going to pick and choose what has been identified and what the leftover. that's going to be exciting times. And so I'm very happy that NASA's taken it on. Now, there's another layer of this that's post NASA conference was Stephen Greer had his own National Press Club event, you know, mm-hmm. where he brings in people that, you know, have experiences. But it's just another big layer of things. Now, some people are not a big fan of Greer, but I did find his press conference pretty interesting. There was a lot of things that were brought up, and one of them was Raytheon over and over again, an American company that's doing a lot of different things that we are not very aware of. And in fact, I'm very nervous because I did write to Raytheon and ask for clarification. I wanted to know, would they have any comment, you know, about what was said? Because, you know, Raytheon got tapped several times of being one of these corporations that's hiding all this stuff away from the American public. So we should get a response from Raytheon, but
we should point out that like after the panel, after the UAP panel that NASA, you know, convened with the 16 people, there was a story that broke out. I think it came out from in debrief. I think the Greer's press conference came after that story in the debrief about craft being on the ground that the United States has them, and
right.
And it made quite a tempest in the teapot for a week or two there, and people are still talking about it now, about, you know, what's out there, but they were very closely linked together, right? There that report came out in the debrief, and then like the very next week was this press conference with some similar claims as well.
It's again where we are now is a whole new cast of characters that are, you know, in some ways, I think there's a cottage industry in keeping this thing alive. People make money on it. You know, so there's some shyster feelings you get in a couple of these kind of groups and people looking at it. But I think you got to take it in totality. And you know, what is it that we're dealing with here? And again, I'd like to see more psychologists involved. You know, I got people sending me emails about time travel, and, you know, it goes on and on. And so who knows what dimension we're really, you know, people want to have all kinds of different multiverse, you know, feelings about our future and where we're headed, and we're in a new dimension, and or we're in kind of a you know, some kind of virtual reality dream trip here as human beings on another planet. So I don't know where we're going, but it's going to be fun at least helping to sort it out.
Well, just to clear the record, I can say with total conviction that Tarek and I are not getting rich off of UFO lore, or actually off of another part of space reporting for that matter.
Wait, if someone's offering, though, right? So let's leave that door open.
Well,
right?
I will point out, as I think I've mentioned, so I just came back from the International Space Development Conference, which Leonard's very familiar with. The NSS has been doing it for decades. And we had about 900 to 1,000 people there, which is a good turnout for us. Yeah. When I was speaking at AlienCon a couple of months ago, there was 9,000 people there, and standing room only to go hear Eric von Däniken as he slowly shuffled his way into the room to talk about, you know, flying pyramids and the Egyptians teleporting themselves to Alpha Centauri and all that stuff. So clearly there's an audience there and money to be made, and History Channel is cleaning up. Kudos to them.
Yeah.
But that aside, I wanted Leonard to ask you if you thought, you know, in terms of citizen science and data gathering, I know there's some apps being worked on, I think at least one in conjunction with the NASA study that people will be able to log on to basically crowdsource their observations. Right. Is this something that might also come out of Avi Loeb's new Galileo project?
Yeah, I think he's on a wavelength of being trying to put scientific rigor in gathering the data and looking at it. And so Avi Loeb and the Galileo Project at Harvard is doing great. I always like him because people get upset with him.
Yes, like exactly. That.
We should say, Avi Loeb,
I don't want the traditional folks in the SETI world to tell me about it. I like these kind of side
heretics.
I call him a side lobe. You know, he's one of these guys that, you know, you can't quibble with his intellect and his background in astrophysics. I think he's you know, putting a high bar on observations, and I think that will help clarify what we're seeing.
Yeah. And Avi Loeb is an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics who has raised the question, I'm going to say, that the Oumuamua and other interstellar objects like that could be could be possible, you know, actual vehicles, to say that we shouldn't rule that out, you know, right, when we're studying these brand new things that we're seeing for the first time. But yeah, and then he's got this new project too.
I think, you know, one thing I keep coming back to in my own mind, I don't need dozens of crashes. I need one. You know, I don't need them to come here all the time. I keep thinking, are they coming? If they're really coming here, are we that special? Why are we being, you know, picked on to be having our sky proliferated with UFOs? I mean, what is it? Maybe it's we are a rare earth, literally, and that's why we're being scrutinized so heavily. And maybe I always go back to the Star Wars bar, and you think about how many aliens are out there. And what kind of aliens? I mean, some alien intelligences may be, you know, maybe that's why they're crashing. They don't have the best technology. They, you know, they got a, you know, an Edsel kind of flying saucer. But when you look at the totality of everything that we've gone through with UFOs and now UAP, got to be something to this. I'm not sure what it is, whether it's, you know, time travel. We're coming back, looking at ourselves, and you know, you get all these side stories about, they're over nuclear test sites. And then we got balloons flying over, and everybody got excited about balloons flying overhead and shooting them down.
Well, pursuant to what you're saying, though, I do wonder, you know, how many people do they have to abduct? There are thousands that think they have right. been. How much investigate? I mean, other than the weird psychological parameters that you find in different people, when you're talking about investigating us as organic beings, how many do they really need to look at? How many lower GI tracts do they have to probe to figure out yeah. that that's where food goes? And how many cows do they have to tip and mutilate, you know? And why mutilate a cow? I mean, I know there's a lot of them standing around. They're easy targets. But yeah. as you point out, these guys came from 100 light years away. They could probably chase down a roadrunner or a coyote if they wanted to. Yeah. So that part really puzzles me. And I think a lot of it's just the lore and the fascination. And one thing we haven't talked about much this time, we have before a little bit, is it's my personal belief that a lot of the people involved in UFO lore, not these studies, but in the lore, you know, the more generalized fascination with it, you know, it's an easy way. This is going to sound judgy. I apologize. It's an easy way to feel special. You don't need to go get a doctorate in ufology
yeah.
to have an opinion on it. You can just go out on some wonky websites and Dark Truth and all that and read about it and say, okay, not only am I an expert, but I got abducted last week and crop circles are real. And, you know, I'm being a little closed-minded here, I guess, but it does, especially when you talk to these people, and you and I, all three of us, go to conferences and we get assaulted by these folks every now and then. And they point at you and say, you're hiding the truth and you use Photoshop to make lies for NASA. And it's like, you know, there's no need. There's no need to do that. You know, there's nothing to cover up. So
yeah, but this all comes at a time when the public by and large, is feeling a little suspect about government.
Yeah. Well, that's not new, though. I mean,
no, it's not new.
You were a hippie once. Never, you were suspicious.
It's never climbed the steps of the Capitol.
And
living in Washington, D.C. for 30 years, I mean, that's a pretty revered place. And to see that happen, it's clear that we've got a partial part of society that and it seems to be growing. It's like that was one worry about the NASA study to me was, you know, the government's here to help you figure it out. And, it comes at a time when I think people are a little worried about the government and how it operates. And I think the Greer thing and Raytheon and all these other Lockheed Martin and some of the big Battelle, there's a bunch of companies that I really get washed into this story. They're pretty interesting. You know, what are they doing at the behest of a quote unquote secret government, some other type of government that we're not aware of is operating? So, yeah, it all feeds on itself.
Well, is there like a solution then for that, Leonard? Is it the need for more things like that Avi Loeb's Galileo project, which, by the way, we didn't explain what that was, but that's a program out of Harvard where Avi Loeb is based to kind of take that search for it's his extraterrestrial technological I cannot pronounce it. Sorry. Extra.
They're scrambling your brain waves from those black vans out in front of your house.
It's Enceladus.
That's a callback right there. Galileo Project for the systematic scientific search for evidence of extraterrestrial technological artifacts. Right. So basically take it from being, Johnny come lately on the, you know, out in his farm in the country to actual, you know, transparent scientific research.
Have built instruments. They've built devices that are specific to this kind of phenomenon. And he's, you know, and I heard that from the military guy on the NASA panel when he gave a talk to the NASA panel, that they're building some special sensors that are going to be hauled around to different locations.
But I guess the key is that this is a separate project from a government project, from a military project. Right. If there are more of those independent academic projects, then there could be less suspicion about the, unless it's just you're going to always be, everyone's in on it together.
Hope, but I think, you know, the history of this kind of shows that no matter how how much rigor some report offers, there'll be people that this is just part of the cover up. You know, even I'm sure at the end of the day, NASA is going to get blasted by some groups that they're all part of the big cover up scheme. So it's going to be hard for NASA, even though they tried to pin themselves as, the clarion call for all science data. And how they go about assembling that data, that's fine. But I think at the end of the day, I'll be surprised if the NASA report falls flat on its face, according to some groups.
Okay, so hold on. I'm getting an incoming communication. Yeah. Oh, Leonard, are you really prepared to go on record to say that you think Donald Trump is working with aliens?
Oh, well, you never know.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm just going to say that he's had like a severed head off screen this entire time. Yeah.
Right? Sorry for those listening on audio. I had a mannequin head whispering in my ear. So I guess the compelling question I have, you know, you've talked about, Leonard, you know, how to sort of narrow the funnel here in terms of data and legitimizing this stuff. So this study is a first step. And hopefully crowdsourcing, I mean, God knows they're going to need AI to narrow down the reports because there will be, I'm sure, tens of hundreds of thousands.
And there was a woman astrophysicist on there that's, if you read her bio, she's also a boxer and she has an incredible background. Very interesting. Mm. She's on the panel and brought up AI and crowdsourcing. And I think she was so definitive on her thinking that that's probably going to be
the next
step. Part of the NASA study, the findings. And yeah.
So what's the
next
step?
We see that with meteors. I mean, like the American Meteor Society has like a whole crowdsource thing for reports and stuff like that.
Yeah, and space debris now. You see this all the time. You know, people are reporting all kinds of things they see coming from the sky.
So what's the next big thing to do to make this work in humanity's favor so that we're not surprised when they do land and start lasering people?
Yeah. Well, I think he got brought up here. The guy that supposedly in the know about crashed UFOs is going to be maybe brought to a hearing, and we'll see what kind of person this guy is. Sounds interesting. There's some documentation behind what he said. Some people are already questioning some of it, but
who is this guy?
I can't remember his name, but he's now the guy that's kind of in the focal point. Well,
I think this is the whistleblower, David Grush, right? Yeah. The former combat officer in Afghanistan. This is from the report in the debrief, and he is the one that is saying that, you know, he's got reports to him that he heard from someone that has seen the crashed vehicles themselves.
And that's what's disturbing in some of this, because I don't want to hear any more people talk about, I know somebody that knows something. You know, we're going to have to know it. You know, the truth is out there. Let's get somebody up there with photos and video that is so compelling you know, you got to salute it. And you know, these people, there's a lot of this. You know, I know a guy that got picked up by a UFO and dropped off at 7-Eleven and lost 45 minutes of his life. And he got, you know, abducted and probed and half naked when he got found. You know, I don't know. You know, it's just, it's tiring after a while. Let's move this story down the road.
So maybe you nailed it. Maybe they're coming all this way to go to 7-Eleven to get Slim Jims, because you can't find Slim Jims anywhere else in the cosmos. But they will find out. They will find out that Slim Jims taste an awful lot like people, because we are classified by some of those islanders way out in the old Pacific 100 years ago that called eating flesh long pig. So maybe the aliens will figure that out. That took a really dark turn. Sorry.
I don't want to be characterized as discounting in anything and everything, but it just seems like we need to rev up the story with some real findings. And, you know, if there's crashed UFOs, and I think the crashed UFO thing also rings a bell in my mind about a special squadron of Air Force people that run around and go collect crashed satellites. And I'm not sure some of this is not mixed up in there, because we do have a, what they call Project Moonlight, I think it was called. I think it was that. And if you go back, and I've done some FOIA on that one, there's some interesting you know, that we're still not sure what has been recovered from space at a time when Russia, we were trying to disassemble crashed Soviet satellites and try to understand more about their manufacturing and any other kind of data we could glean from there. So I think that may be one element that needs to be considered with people identifying crashed objects from space.
It's very convenient to have a UFO cover story when you're trying to reverse engineer your opposing country's satellite space-based assets. So
about distraction. Well, Leonard, we thank you for coming in again. We'll have you back when this final study does get released. And thanks everyone for joining us for our chat with Leonard David, a space reporter.
Yeah.
Leonard, what's the best place for us to keep track of what you're up to?
Well, I have my own website, leonarddavid.com. Okay. I try to post as much stuff as I can muster up the energy for, and also put on space.com articles that I've written so people can see them there as well.
Yeah, and it's a great resource for anybody who hasn't been there. I do think you need to change your background color away from brown, but that's just me.
Well, okay. we should also point out that if you want to, I mean, Leonard has written a lot of books like yourself, Rod, about moon exploration, going to Mars, all sorts of good stuff. So he's got a good library of stuff to get into too.
Yeah, and some of his are still on the front list instead of the back list, like so many of mine. So congratulations on that. Tarek, where can we keep our much-needed eye on you?
Well, as always, you can find me at space.com, also still on the Twitter, at Tarek J. Malik, and just looking for whatever this this NASA panel is going to bring to the forefront, and also what the next launch is going to be to get up there and find it.
All right. Well, keep your eagle eye on it. And of course, you can always find me at pilebooks.com and at adastromagazine.com. Please don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We always welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas, and we answer every single email. Don't forget also to check out space.com, websites in the name, and the National Space Society at nss.org. Both are good places to satisfy your space flight cravings and probably other stuff. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, and give us reviews. We'll take 5 stars, a thumbs up, or a dart in the bullseye, anything you like. You can also head to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. Finally, don't forget you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there for just $7 a month. And you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook, and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. And you already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.